Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 27th of Nisan. Today, we're going to see Shu'at Rabbi Omer, Volume 7. This is Rabbi Yosef's Tshuvot, Volume 7, the Or Chaim section, Siman Chaf Aleph, responsible number 21. And as always, we begin with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, and to David Hachhauser for their help in putting these shiurim online and available to you. Today, I'm also cheating a little bit in that I'm taking the date of the question rather than the date of the answer. To some extent, that's because when I was looking at other responses, this is the one that jumped out at me as one that I wanted to deal with. That sort of takes away a little bit from the randomizing effect. But maybe the other way around. Maybe that I let myself cheat every so often makes it as much random. I don't know. I'll find out when, God willing, one day the book comes out. Meanwhile, if you ever want to contact me about this choice, about other issues that come up in the shiurim, my email is grothst@gmail.com. And here we go. The chief rabbinate of Argentina, the letter, the question is signed by Yitzhak Moshe Schreiber. Now, that's what he spells it, Shinchet Yud Bet Resh. It could be it's Schreiber. I think it's Schreiber, and I think it's like Schreiber, but it's like a Syrian writing of it. We'll see that in the question he mentions that he was Syrian, that he's from, that he himself was in Aleppo, and he signs it as a Sephardi Tahor. So I'm not sure why I would have gotten the name Schreiber, but I don't know what else. Maybe it's Shechiver? I don't know. Anyway, he is the chief rabbi of Buenos Aires, and he writes, along with the chief rabbi of Argentina, he writes the following question to Rabbi Yosef. They have a small yeshiva in Buenos Aires. It's called Yeshivat Beit David. They have about 80 students. That's Tamidim ve'Avrechim. So Tamidim are school students, school-age students. Elementary school and high school, I think, and or maybe just high school. And Avrechim would be kolel guys who are learning beyond high school. So many of the parents of the students in this school, they're willing to send their kids to a yeshiva, but after school, in the evening, they send them to another school to learn English. So this is in Argentina, where English is not the native tongue, but they want to learn English for reasons of parnasaf, reasons of being able to make a living at the end of their schooling. And so the boys are sent to a non-Jewish school where the classes are co-ed, one thing, also Jews and non-Jews. And the way they write it, the question is, the phrase that it jumped out at me was, "Umaya aseh habein velo yechta." How could it be that our kids won't sin if they're in that situation? So we'll get to the rest of the question in a second, but let me just digress, if you don't mind, for a second, and point out that that's an interesting and important question, and I don't know that the answer is as important as the question, meaning I think there are plenty of people who don't bother to ask themselves that question. It's one thing if you say to yourself, I feel like I put my kid in an environment where there are challenges, religious and spiritual challenges, and here's how I'm going to confront them. But I think that many people would, at least in the communities that I know, who aren't of the more what we call today right-wing group, would say, well, you have to do it, so you have to do it. But that's not an answer, right? If it's true, if you knew for a fact that livelihood would be significantly more difficult for your kid if they don't know English. On the other hand, if you knew for a fact that 90% of the kids who were going to learn English would leave your religion. So it seems to me that the obvious answer should be, well, then you can't do it. Unless you have some reason to think that your kid is in the 10%, but some real reason. And that kind of questioning, I think, is an important set of questioning that in communities that I often deal with, the question doesn't even arise. What the answer is, there's a range of answers that you could have. In this case, in Buenos Aires, they feel that sending these kids to these schools where they're going to, at a relatively young age, meet non-Jewish kids, meet girls, meet this and this and this, will tend to lead to inappropriate activity. And therefore, that's not the issue. They want to solve that problem, right? These are, you know, I think they come off as sounding as good, intelligent people who are looking to create a good, meaningful observance. And to solve that problem, what they decided was they would hire an English teacher, and he would, in the building, in Bishivat Beit David, he would teach English after hours to the kids, whoever wants to be in an English teaching class, instead of having to go to that non-Jewish school, wherever it was, after the learning is over for the day, they would then go to this class. And now, this class, the key point is, it's going to be, they don't have a big building. It's an 80, you know, it's an 80-student operation. They don't have a huge building. So this class is going to take place in the same room as during the day they study Torah. It's in the Beit Midrash itself. So there are those who are saying that it's not allowed because there's halacha in the Ben Ishkai. And the Ben Ishkai, let's remember, was an important posek for Sfardim. It was a very important posek for Sfardim from when he was Zil. One of the things that, I don't know this stuff, but the biographers of Rav Yosef suggest is that part of what he did in the Sephardic community was to, the academic term is actually reify. I'm not one of those people who use these kinds of words usually, but it's the correct word. He put back into power, into place, the Shulchan Aruch, even as opposed to where the Ben Ishkai, a later authority, had ruled differently. The Ben Ishkai tended to be more stringent than Shulchan Aruch on some things. And Sfardim had accepted many of the Ben Ishkai's psakim. And one of the things that Rav Yosef, I think, does is that he says, you don't always have to follow the Ben Ishkai. He says it respectfully, but that's what he says. So the Ben Ishkai had said, Sh'asur lilmod ktiva ukriya shel lishonot u'mot ha'olam b'beit ha'midrash. You can't learn the writing and the reading of non-Jewish languages, non-Torah languages, in a Beit Midrash. In other words, Ben Ishkai's claim is that the Beit Midrash, a study hall, is a place of kedusha, of sanctity, and therefore you're not allowed to use it for unsanctified purposes such as reading and writing non-Jewish languages. But the man writing, the chief rabbi of Buenos Aires, this is Moshe Schreiber, said, I'm not sure I understand that, because we have another halakha that says, and this is from the Gemara already, that Torah scholars and their students can eat and drink in the Beit Midrash, because it's a need of theirs, and they sort of live in the Beit Midrash, so that need that they have, they're allowed to do. Now, that question that we're going to get into a little bit in the answer to, I remember coming up when I was in yeshiva, in Yeshivat Haaretzion, and also in YU, was a question that came up a lot, because there were people who held, yes, we're allowed to eat and drink in the Beit Midrash, and they would, and there were others who held, you're not really supposed to, and therefore they were opposed to it. So that's a whole question of its own. But this rabbi in Buenos Aires is saying, he thinks that now we're placed teaching English to these boys, since it's going to be very essential for their livelihood in the future, and therefore they won't need, that he thinks it's sort of like eating and drinking. Now, you could obviously argue back that eating and drinking is an immediate need, whereas this is an eventual need. So he adds more ideas. He also says, and by the way, by letting them have the classes here, then they won't need to leave school early to get to that other class. Meaning, you know, if that night class, let's say, was at 5 o'clock, I'm making up numbers, but let's say that class was at 5 o'clock, and the yeshiva, they ended at 5 o'clock, these boys would need to leave at 4 o'clock in order to be able to get their class. But if they know they're going to have an English class in their yeshiva at 5 o'clock, they won't need to leave early, or 5:30, they'll give them a break. They won't need to leave early, they'll be able to stay here. And also, they won't mix with non-Jews, boys and girls, and there will be that benefit of helping them, you know, develop more in a fully Jewish environment and not have to face that challenge when they're not ready for it. And also, he says, he thinks it might help other parents decide to send their kids to this school, meaning you have a certain population already that's willing to patronize the school. But there's probably another population out there who would say, oh, give my kids a good Jewish education. Sounds good, but I don't want them suffering. It'd be like many today. There are many schools that say that the ability to tell parents that their kids will be able to get into, you know, a good college and therefore be able to set themselves up for a good livelihood is actually a draw for those parents to send their kids to a Jewish school where they might otherwise not. And so that draw, he says, is also a value. And so does this value, do all these values, he thinks that all these values should seem to outweigh the question of, are we allowed to use the Beit Midrash for these purposes? And then he says, and I remember when I was in Aram Tzova, which in parentheses they put Chalab, which is Aleppo in Syria. So this man is writing, you know, this is a letter from Tafshin Babiket from 1988, and this man had still been born in Aleppo. The Jewish community of Aleppo didn't completely disintegrate until really, really fairly late in history, like very fairly recently. So he says he remembers that back in Aleppo, Rashi Yeshiva, the heads of Yeshiva, would bring French teachers, right? And Aleppo in Syria was a French colony originally, so French was the language they were learning. So they would bring teachers to teach French, and they would do it in the same rooms as the Beit Midrash. So that seems like a parallel thing to us teaching English to these. So that's the question that he's writing to Rav Yosef, who answers on the third of Sivan of Tafshin Mem Chet. I could have theoretically used this as a response for third Sivan, but I was looking for 27 Nisan, and this was the best option that appeared to me, so that's what we're doing it today. So, he points out, there is a Gemara in Megillah. This is where the Rav Yosef starts the answer. The Gemara in Megillah on Chaf Chet at the bottom of Amud Aleph has Tana Rabbanan, Batei Knesiot Einu Agin Mehem Kalut Rosh. When you have a Beit Knesset, you're not allowed to act with levity, to act lightly in them, and this means even not at the time of davening, not at the time of prayer, you're just not allowed to do it at all. And you're not allowed to eat, and you're not allowed to drink there, and you're not allowed to get any benefit from there. So Rashi says benefit means you're not allowed to decorate yourself there, you're not allowed to just go for a walk there. And let's say somebody said, you know, I want to walk around the shul 17 times, because that'll be 3 miles of walking, that's my exercise. Can't do it, because the shul, you can't use it for those purposes. In the condition that Gemara, Amar Ravasi, but taking a siyot ship in Bavel, but the shuls in Bavel, al tenai, they build them on a tenai. But the condition is, we can use them for other purposes than just the Beit HaKnesset. I remember once, many years ago, when I was a rabbi in a shul, and I, a couple of times, tried to speak up about davening, about talking during davening. There was a rabbinical student in the shul at the time, and he came up to me and said, I don't understand why you keep trying hard to convince people they're not allowed to talk during davening. Just tell them they can't talk in a shul, you know, casual talk, even when it's not being used as a shul. And I said to him, I think that most shuls today, even in Rav Yosef, we'll get into it, we tend to assume today that when he says Bavel there, doesn't mean only in Bavel, but that we build most of our shuls al tanai, and that therefore we think we can use them for other purposes, that we build most of our shuls as what we call multi-purpose rooms, and that complicates the question. It's still true, the Rav Yosef says, but you shouldn't be noe colored rosh, you shouldn't act in a silly, in a silly manner, even when there's no davening going on, even though it's built for multiple purposes, but that's hard to convince people of. Anyway, in the Gemara it says, "Umayuniu cheshbonot." Kalat rosh would be like calculations. So, but then Rava comes along, says, "Amar Rava, chachamim tamidim, that Torah scholars and their students are allowed." We said this before, eat and drink, and it's because it's like their home. So Frey Rashi, my Bei Rabbanan. Why is it called a Bei Rabbanan? The Beit Midrash is referred to as Bei Rabbanan. It's that it's sort of like a house up there. It's just the same way you eat in your house. You can eat and drink. These people can eat and drink in the Beit Midrash. So that seems to imply, perhaps, that there's room to say that in Beit Midrash, we build as a multi-purpose room inherently. And since Torah scholars are allowed to eat and drink there, that other uses that are important for the benefit of Torah scholars should also be allowed. It's not clear that that's true. Let's check. We're going to check more sources to see whether that's true. But that's the first possibility that arises from this Gemara. The question is whether that's the consensus of postgame about this issue. So the way the Rambam paskins it, the Rav Yosef points out to us, the way the Rambam paskins it is, he says, right, which is not always the exact same thing, shuls and study halls, places of prayer and places of study, ein hagin bahem kalut rosh. You don't act lightheadedly, with levity, jocularly, too loosely in them. But then he also includes, but Torah scholars and their students are allowed to eat and drink in them, but then he puts in the word at the end of that discussion, midochak. So midochak means from pressure. So the Kesef Mishnah there says, what does he mean midochak? He gets it from Megillah Chavchet Amid Bet, that he understood the sugya there, that the permission to eat and drink is only when there's pressure there that makes them need to eat and drink there. And the Ramban and the Ran all agree that even though the places of prayer in Bavel are built on the condition that they can use them for other purposes, and even though we say the Torah scholars and their students are allowed to eat and drink there, but it sounds like, first of all, it's not in shuls, it's only in Batei Midrash, only in study halls, because they're there all day, but not in synagogues. So that would be fine for our yeshiva in Buenos Aires, because they're a Beit Midrash rather than a Beit HaKnesset. So that's the first step that you have. You have several important Mishonim who understood the sugya to say that you're not really supposed to ideally be eating and drinking there, but it's midochak if you have pressure to do it. L'fizah, Rashi, Rav Rana, Chulkim, Rambam, Matir, Beit Midrash, Afilu Shalom, midochak. So the way the Rashi and the Ran phrased it, though, it sounds like in a shul they agree with the Rambam, but in a Beit Midrash, they think it doesn't have to be dochak. It doesn't have to be there's some specific pressure. It's just that a study hall is like the place, since they're there all day. It's the place the Torah scholars live, since it's the place they live. They're allowed to eat and drink there. Rav Yosef adds that he saw the Rav Yah, and the Rav Yah also thinks that when we say the Torah scholars are allowed to do this, he thinks it means eating and drinking, and also sleeping, and he thinks it's a shul as well as a Beit Midrash. So that would be a very great leniency, because he seems to think that as long as one tends to use these places all day, and they become their place, and their multi-purpose rooms, then you're fully allowed to do it. So you have now a range of opinions, and the question in these situations is always, where in the range do you choose to come at? You have the Rambam thinking that even Torah scholars, even in a study hall, it's only mitochak. You have the Rashba and the Ran, who seems to think that in a prayer place, it's a problem, but in a study hall, it's even not midochak. And then you have the Rav Yah, who goes even further, and he thinks that both in prayer places, but the Knesset, as well as in study halls, you can have eating and drinking and sleeping and all those things. The Meiri seems to be on the more lenient side as well, and he defines some of these issues for us better also. He talks about taking this issue of Bavel, and we'll later see that many people think that Bavel is not the only place that they do it. They make a condition when they build them that they can go in, the way he understood it as, Likanes Likitsat Hana. They can go in even for some minimal amount of pleasure. If it's hot outside, they want to get some shade, they can go in and use it. So that's a question, because it seems like you're using it for your own purposes, or from the rain. And then he says, but you can't have Kalut Rosh there. When he defines Kalut Rosh, which I've been defining as lightheadedness or levity or jocularity, he says it's based on the Gemara talking about Cheshbonot, it's Cheshbonot Shebein Adam LaChavero. It's calculations between a man and his friend. So it sounds like it would be even like a business negotiation. You owe me this much money, I owe you that much money, or how much, you know, or some other kinds of calculations like that. And there are those, he says, there are those who permit Cheshbonot Shel Tzibor. There are those who would permit having some kind of talking about money or calculating or thinking about math problems and math issues or accounting issues, perhaps, if they're the community ones. And this would be room for having appeals in shul, right? How can you have an appeal in shul? Isn't that Kala Rosh talking about money, talking about this, talking about that? So that would be the room to say that. If you think that when we build the Mala tonight, that you're allowed, that included in that, is that you're allowed to do Cheshbonot Shel Tzibor, that would be the room for it. And so too, the Magen Avraham, this is already in Shulchan Aruch, in the commentaries of Shulchan Aruch that are well accepted, he gave a reason for the eating and the drinking. He says, not because it's their house in that sense. He doesn't take that as literally and therefore as fully as others might. He says, since they live there and they're there all the time, if we require them to go home every time they wanted to eat, there would be such distraction from their learning and so much time taken away from their learning. But if they don't learn in a Beit HaKnesset, if they don't learn in the shul, then he thinks it's completely prohibited, because the whole question of Talmidei Chachamim was a function of, we said it's like their house, but what we meant by their house was we want to reduce their commuting time so they don't lose time from Torah study. So if they don't study in the Beit HaKnesset, that's not where people study. They study in the Beit Midrash, as you have in many, many buildings, then the Beit Knesset has none of that element to it, because they also have an obligation of Bora Mikdash, of having fear of a place of prayer. So meeting, or awe is a better word, meaning that the place that we tend to pray to Hashem is a place that we should approach with awe. That becomes a whole question of whether we're allowed to, even with a Tanai, what we are or aren't allowed to do in that place. And the Magen Avraham is saying that unless it's the place where the Torah scholars study, such that the calculus is that by letting them eat there we are saving study time, unless that's true, they're not allowed to eat there either. On the other hand, there was also a tradition, and this is where we get, let's say, having Kiddush and Shul on Friday night, there's a tradition that you'd have people who were guests of the community, travelers, they didn't have any place to stay, and if the people of the community didn't have any place for them to stay, they would let them stay in the shul. So if they were going to stay in the shul and sleep in the shul, so the Shibbol HaLeket, the name of the Gaonim, and it's brought in the Beit Yosef, says that if that's where they are guests, then they can eat and drink in the shul, because that's what it was made for in that sense. It was one of the conditions upon which it was built, and therefore that's not considered Kalut Rosh, because it was embedded in the building of it. So you could eat and drink in the shul, those people could eat and drink in the shul. All that is background, but the crucial source that Rav Yosef is going to bring for us is he notes that Sefer Itim quotes Rav Chaim Gaon. And we're going to see Rav Chaim Gaon is a Gaon, by which I don't mean he was a genius. I mean he was a leader of the Babylonian Yeshivot and was therefore old. It's pre-Rishonim, basically. It's the end of the Gaonic period, but pre-Rishonim, and therefore extremely authoritative. And Rav Chaim Gaon was already asked about this question. And he said, according to the Sefer Itim, Rav Chaim Gaon said, you can teach children while you're teaching them Torah, or in the context, not while and like in the same moment, but in the context of teaching them Torah, you can also teach them Arabic and Cheshbonot and mathematics. Aval shaloi matorah einu nachon. But without Torah, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it means like in the context, meaning while I'm teaching them Torah, I'll teach them Arabic by speaking Arabic to them and correcting their Arabic while they're teaching, having the right maybe chidushi Torah in Arabic, so they'll learn Arabic. And same thing with math. You know, when the math issue comes up in the context of Torah study, I'll make sure to teach them all this math stuff to make sure they can learn the Torah well enough. But without Torah, he says it's inappropriate. many sense. And if you're going to have non-Jewish students who want to learn, right, let's say you become known as a good educator in those issues, and therefore non-Jews want to sign up for your classes, so if they want to come in, the classes are in a shul, it's preferable to find a way to avoid it. But if you're worried that they'll cause a fight, they'll be annoyed, they'll be insulted, they'll be upset, so then they darkei shalom, right, we have lots and lots of halakhot that we keep to because we say we want to get along with our non-Jewish neighbors as well as we can, so we allow various things. So that is the way that the Sefer Itim quotes Rav Haigon. Now, in another Sefer Itim Labina, he was surprised by that because the Gemara that we spoke about before says you don't do math, you don't have cheshbonot in shuls or in Batei Midrash, and he says, no, if it's letzorech dvar mitzvah, if it's for the needs of a mitzvah, so for example, in Kiddushin it says, you have an obligation to teach your kid a trade so they can make a living when they grow up. So therefore, he understood Rav Haigon to be saying it's a mitzvah to teach your kid Arabic and teach your kid math so they can be able to support themselves when they grow up. And therefore, he thinks that kind of a mitzvah purpose is not the cheshbonot, is not the math the Gemara and the Megillah referred to. The Gemara and Megillah called cheshbonot kalut rosh. It called it levity, it called it silliness, it called it nothing valuable. So if it's got a mitzvah purpose to it, that can't be what it meant, is what the Itim Labina suggested. So that would mean, if I'm just going to play math games in my head or for the fun of it, that you can't do in a shul. But if it's math that has some valuable purpose to it, so there, the suggestion would be, that Rav Haigon was saying that you could do it, but even so, it was only a gav gurara shel limud Torah. That was only in conjunction with, and accompany with, the Torah study. Because, says the Bina Itim Labina, or maybe this is Rav Yosef explaining it, because learning a profession and learning math itself isn't a full mitzvah its own. It's a grama for a mitzvah. What's the grama for a mitzvah? It causes the ability to support oneself when one gets older. So there's a value to that. But not everything that's valuable is a mitzvah, even though commonly today many people will say, oh, it's a mitzvah, when they just mean it's got value to it. But this is not the same thing, and that's important for here, because if you want to talk about whether you can teach what we today maybe call secular studies in the context of a shul or a Beit Midrash, if it was an absolute mitzvah to do it, then obviously you could. But Rav Haigon's quote seems to say that it's not an absolute mitzvah in that sense that would allow doing it in that room unless it's in some way subsumed under the Talmud Torah. Right? In the context of Talmud Torah, you find a way to slip in. It would be sort of similar to, very different from, but those who would, let's say, have taught themselves German by reading a German Bible. They knew the Torah, and they knew, and so when they were reading the translation, they could pick up what the German words meant, and they could pick up German that way. So that would be sort of a gav gurara. I'm not saying it was a perfect idea, but a gav gurara in the context of learning their Torah studies, they would pick up the Arabic and the math as well. Another halacha that seems to point to the same thing is halacha in Shulchan Aruch Choshen Mishpat. And this gets into the question of, when people used to live very close to each other, or in they would share a courtyard, let's say. Today, you can imagine it would be a homeowners association, you know, in a narrow block, and they have rules about what people can and can't do. So if one of the members of a mavoi, of a courtyard or an alleyway that everybody shares, is a doctor, or a malamet, you know, coach no shel Torah, and he teaches to elementary school children, but he teaches them subjects that are not Torah subjects, then the B'nei HaMavoi can be me'akvim. They can say, we don't want a school or a hospital or a doctor's office in our Mavoi. Right? It's like a zoning issue where they can say, we have a zoning issue against such businesses being conducted in our Mavoi. But in terms of teaching Torah, they're not allowed to do it. They're not allowed to disagree because teaching Torah is so important, etc. Rabbi Yosef is pointing out, though, that Shulchan Aruch seems to imply that teaching math, teaching other languages, even though it's necessary for profession, would not be sufficiently of a mitzvah purpose that we would say that, no, you're allowed to do it in the Mavoi, even over the objections of your neighbors. So apparently it's not a full mitzvah. That would explain Rav Haigon. It's all going to come back to our question of whether you can do it in this yeshiva's room, therefore. That's going to be the question we're going to have. Then Rav Yosef gets to the quoting part. I'm not going to quote everything, but he has a shoot. Vayomer Yitzchak, he says you can't do such things in a room of Kedusha. Rav Yosef says, with all due respect, you didn't know what Rav Haigon said. Rav Haigon said you didn't need a mitzvah rabbi. You didn't need a great mitzvah to be allowed to do it. You needed just some kind of a mitzvah purpose, along with the fact that it was subsumed under the Torah study. Then there's a shoot Shari Rachamim Franco, also talking about whether you should permit teaching writing and the language of that place that you're living in the rooms of a Talmud Torah. And this, Shara Chaim Franco held that the obligation of a father to teach his kid umnos, teach his kid a profession, was sufficient to allow doing it in the rooms of the Talmud Torah. And also he points out that in Gemara and Shabbat, Beit Hillel hold, Mesharkin ala tinok lamdo sefer ve'umna, you can on Shabbat discuss teaching a child a profession and math and things like that. And if you can do that, then apparently it's enough of a mitzvah purpose to allow speaking about it on Shabbat. And therefore he thought it would be enough of a purpose to allow doing it in the room of a Talmud Torah, of a Beit Midrash, like we were talking about. In Eretz Yisrael, Rav Yosef says, we see many people who are mekel on this, that the teachers for math and for writing and for the local language, you know, which wasn't, you know, let's say the British, in the British Mandate time, let's say, or whatever it is, the local language, they do it in the rooms of the Talmud Torah, and we've never heard anybody who disagreed. That's what Shara Chaim Franco, I think, was writing. So his conclusion is, and he questions whatever, we'll leave some of this aside because we're running out of time. But his conclusion is that if there's no other room, then it should be okay. But if you have another room to do it in, so that's an important question here. This Beit Midrash seems to have had basically only one room, and that's why they had to do the teaching in that room after hours. But if you have another room, it's clearly preferable to do it in the other room. So too, Sri De Eish was asked during the Nazi times, while the Nazis were in control, the Nazis made a rule that Jews were only allowed to assemble at their shuls, at their Bate Knesset. So the question was, can we therefore have lectures in the shul of a non-Torah variety about how to earn a living, right? You know, how to get around the Nazi rules so you can earn a living, how to encourage people that don't give up hope, how to keep people from going. If they don't come here and they have free time, they might go to other places where they'll hear non-Torah ideas or secular ideas. You know, you might have secular Jews would say, no, this is the way to cope with these troubles that we're having now. So Sri Nation is a long tshuva, and eventually, Rabbi Yosef says, he was only matir things that were themselves a mitzvah. So he was matir in this case, which is interesting because Sri Nation very often, I think, is thought of as a mekel, and very often I've seen him to be a mekel. But on this issue, he was matir. He said it has to be in a shul because of the sanctity of a shul. It has to be things that are themselves some kind of a mitzvah. On the other hand, right, he says, I saw in Shut Rav Pe'alim to Rav Yosef Chaim, who is the Benish Chaim, we've seen before, was one of the ones that we thought was going to have a problem with. And here too, he says, how could you imagine allowing an Arab, who's going to teach them Arabic, to teach them writing and language, how could you imagine that we would do this in the Makom Kadosh, in a place of tefillah in Torah? It's got to be that it's got to be, and he says, therefore, it's got to be that Rav Haigal didn't mean in that place. It's got to be that he meant in a place right next to the shul. So Rav Yosef says, with all due respect, quote Torah to, I think that he didn't pay attention to the language of Haigon. Haigon seems to have accepted it, that you could do it even in that place if it was necessary and if it was in the context of Talmud Torah. Then he sees Shut Yaskil Avdi, which is Ravad Yadaya, who was an important Rav just older than, and he was the head of Porat Yosef. I think he was like a little bit older than Ravad Yosef. He was like 30 years older than Ravad Yosef, and he was the head of Yeshivat Beit El. In any case, an important Rav of just the generation just before Yosef, and he and Shut Yaskil Avdi was also about this question from the island of Jerba. We've seen some of the Chivot Shoel Venishal of Rav Moshe, Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen of Jerba. So this was the question came to Ravai Tadaya from Jerba, that the person who teaches kids Tanakh and Talmud on Fridays would teach them writing and math. And now they were teaching French as well, and it's all happening in the shul, in the Beit HaKnesset. So the person who was writing the question, who was a Rav too, he writes at length trying to prove that it should be okay. Ravai Yudaya writes at length to say it's not true, and he's machmir. So Ravai Yosef says, and I looked at the tshuva, and I think that he didn't prove the points. And then I've skipped a lot in the tshuva, as I do in all of Ravai Yosef's tshuvot, because he writes, to me, what seems to be at great length, and certainly in terms of being able to present it to you within the time frame that we have for these discussions. And then he puts in parentheses and brackets that he heard from Rav Meir Mazoz, who's a Rav of his time, that his father, who was a man named Rav Matzliach Mazoz, whose tshuvot, whose response are in the responsa project, it's Shut Ich Matzliach, we've just never gotten around to seeing them. And Rav Yosef writes that Rav Matzliach Mazoz writes to disagree with Rav Yadaya, with Yaskil Avdi, Rav Yosef writes about it. Chazar v'heshiv be'orach. He wrote at great length. And so this Rav Meir Mazoz gives him his father's tshuva, and Rav Yosef says, arukah me'eret midah. It's longer than I can possibly cope with to think about, and that he was writing to answer every single claim that Rav Yadai had made. And so Rav Yosef says, basically, I didn't have time to go through it all, which is so interesting, because Rav Yosef is not somebody who writes in great brevity. So watching the question of what's considered long and what's considered short, to me, that's always an interesting thing. So apparently, this Rav Matzliach Mazoz had written it at such length that even Rav Yosef didn't feel like he had the time, or he wasn't able to go through it all. And he says, "Maybe God willing, I'll get to it." In any case, his conclusion is right that we can be makel because we've got all these opinions that are makel. We've got the Orzarua and all those who went with the Orzarua. That when we say Batei Knesiot of Bavel were made with a condition, we mean not just Bavel; we mean all Batei Knesiot, all shuls. And then it's not only when they're destroyed, that's a whole discussion that we skipped, right? It might be only when they're not being used as shuls. He says, nope, even they're still being used as shuls. We have this Rav Haigal who said that you're allowed. And he says, even though the Shulchan Aruch didn't write it, he thinks we have a Sveik Sveika, right? Either we have two doubts about whether or not this applies, that we have to do this. And therefore, and he says also, we hear in Eretz Yisrael see all the time that people are willing to do this. You have a lot of yeshivas that are making all this issue, and they allow, for the purpose that we've said, teaching these subjects in their room. So then he blesses him at the end, that one day, God willing, you'll have enough money and enough of an institution, you'll be able to make separate rooms for the teaching of these studies. So that is a tshuva of Rav Yosef's responding to a question from the 27th of Nisan. Note that nowhere in the tshuva, or even in the people that he quotes, was the idea of teaching these languages and teaching these skills ever taken to be anything less than fine. Right? It was all part of making sure that your kid had an umnut, had a profession, and that was something that was just completely taken for granted by all of these people. The only question was whether or not you could do it in a particular room because of the sanctity of that room. But the idea that there was value to it, and might be even some kind of mitzvah, although not a mitzvah rabbah, that was taken for granted, and it's maybe some thoughts and ideas and attitudes that have been somewhat lost in some circles. But that is a responsible day for the 27th of Nisan. With thanks to the OU, to David Hakazar, and to Rabbi Jacob Bromowitz, I bid you a good day.